is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I'm talking to Charles Kaiser. He's the author of a book called The Cost of Courage, which is about, I'll give a little, just a little lead up to it before I start asking Charles questions, but it's about this family in Paris during World War II, and I think it's an amazing story and really a beautifully written book. So I want to praise you right up front, Charles, for this, which is, you know.
Thank you, David.
I found it, you know, it was one of those books where, as they say, kind of tritely, you can't put it down, but I actually did have to finish it, you know, quick, you know, I just kept wanting to read more. So, but maybe you could talk a little bit, because there, you know, this is a story that has very personal connections to you, as you elucidate at the beginning of the book. This goes back to when you were 10 years old. And it's a pretty interesting accident that puts you in the position to write this book. Your uncle Henry, right? I got his name as Uncle Henry?
My Uncle Henry Kaiser, yes.
Yeah, who was a flyer in World War II. And
no, he was in the Army. He was a lieutenant in the Army. He was already a lawyer. He was actually the labor advisor to the occupying U.S. Army in Paris, and gets there sometime around November of 1944, immediately after the liberation.
Got it. For some reason, I had assumed that he must have been, you know, in the Air Force. I'm not sure why. Of course, it was the Army Air Force during that time, because my father—that's what my father was in. So, but he ends up in Paris, and apparently, what was going on was that, you know, it had just been liberated. It had been under German control for almost 5 years, and the Americans advertised in the newspaper for people to put up their...
There was such a severe housing shortage in Paris immediately after the liberation, because so many people came back to Paris who had fled during the war, that the Army actually put an ad in the newspaper seeking housing for U.S. Army officers, and Christian and Jacqueline Bouloche, living in their parents' big empty apartment in the 16th arrondissement, saw this ad and took my uncle in rent-free for a year in gratitude to the Allies. And he heard all of the amazing stories of what they had done during the war when they were fresh and new. And I heard all of those stories from him when I was a very young child, because they were the most amazing stories anybody had ever heard. And then from the age of 10, whenever I went to France, which was quite often because we lived in Africa and in Europe in this period, this was the family that I stayed with. So Christiane, in particular, is the woman who I fell in love with as my personal hero of the French Resistance when I was 11 and she was 36, I think.
So, and of course, you were growing up at that time. Her kids were roughly, you know, not identical to your age, but roughly your age. So,
all of her, there are four children, and they're all just a little bit younger, a little bit older than me, yes.
Right. So one thing that struck me as curious, and that is, you know, you pointed out, I mean, the story, I don't want to give away the entire story, so we have to talk around it a little bit so okay. People can read it for themselves. But, you know, their story is very painful personally for them because of things that happened to members of their family and to them, you know, to Christiane in particular, being tortured by the Gestapo.
No, Christiane was not tortured.
I'm sorry, Jacqueline was tortured.
No, neither of the sisters were tortured. It was other members of the family.
Got it.
It was actually her mother. It was their mother.
Oh, that's right. You know what I've done? I've actually conflated that story a little bit with another book that I've just finished reading. But they still, I mean, she worked in the resistance. She, many of her friends were killed, and of course, family members as well. And you point out that growing up, her children did not, you know, what happened in the war was always there, but it was not something that was frequently talked about.
It was a taboo subject. It was something you did not bring up. And if something about World War II came on the television set, Christiane or her sister or brother would leave the room. So it was not to be reminded of these events. The only thing they did was an annual ceremony to commemorate those who they had lost, which was done at Père Lachaise, and it was once a year. And they talked about it who had gone and who had died for the liberty of France. And the ceremony lasted for about 20 minutes, and they went back and had lunch together, the whole extended family, and then they did not speak about the war for another 364 days.
So there's this sort of odd thing that happens because of your telling this story. Now, first of all, you know, they did tell the stories to your uncle when they were fresh. So obviously they were able and willing to talk about it at one time. But then as time went on, the sort of scar tissue grew, it feels like. So
the curtain really came down when they got married and they turned the page and they put all of their energy into raising their new families and not thinking about what it was that they lived through. And that's the way it was until about 1997, when Christiane's last surviving sister dies of leukemia, meaning that Christiane is the last surviving member of her generation, and she realizes that if she doesn't do something, this story is going to die with her. And being, above all, a woman of duty, she hires a young Sorbonne student research assistant, and with her help writes 44 pages about the events of the war for her grandchildren. And that she does at the end of the 1990s, and that opens things up so that I can then ask her to speak to me about the same thing, which she's not the least bit eager to do, but she is now willing to do.
Right. So did you feel like, I mean, because this story was so personal to you, and I mean, what did you feel from the, you know, your generation of the members of the family? Were they kind of happy that you were able to finally tell this story?
They were very, once they actually read the book, which took a very, very, very long time, they were extremely happy that I had told their story. And in fact, the best moment, I think, of this entire experience was summer before last, when the book had just come out and they'd all just read it. And I was sitting outside with Christiane and her oldest daughter, Catherine. And Catherine said, "We're very lucky that you fell in love with our story." And I said, "No, no, I'm the lucky one." And Christiane said, "It's reciprocal." Which is about as much as I could hope for.
Well, I think they, you know, they were lucky that, you know, this sort of amazing story could be told by someone with writing ability as yours. I mean, that is, you know, there's luck there. That
sure.
You know,
but also I think I really did help to give them closure. And the most important sentence in the book is there are more triumphs than tragedies in this story. Even though there are a lot of tragedies, nevertheless, there are more triumphs than tragedies. And I wanted to remind the children of that because they, on some level, they resented the pregnant silence that they grew up under, because they were very much aware of the trauma in a non-specific way that their parents had gone through during the war. But at the same time, they were never able to talk about it with their parents during their childhood and adolescence. And there was a certain amount of resentment about that. So they were also relieved that this whole subject was kind of finally out in the open, I think.
Well, and I think for anybody, we can all, kind of be reminded of the stories in our families that are never told. They may not be as poignant, you know, as this one is a really historical and incredibly powerful story, but you think about
every family has its secrets, of course.
Yeah, and they get to have this story told as a narrative that connects their own family to the history
larger
of
events. But yeah, just really one of the most important things to me about the book was that I wanted desperately to place it in the context of the major events, which is why I give you those little mini histories of the Normandy invasion and the liberation of Paris and even the last attempt to assassinate Hitler, to remind people that there was, in fact, a German resistance as well as a French resistance.
Right. No, that
very different nature.
That was very important. I think the book is, transcends you know, it makes it possible for the book to be more than the telling of individual heroism and glory, which or and survival, which I think is important to tell. There's no question that that's, you know, meaningful. But I think it is important to place it in a context where, you know, where it belongs. And also to realize, as you just pointed out, how complicated life was. And, you know, this was not... you know, individuals find themselves in historical settings and are challenged then to act. And but still, the historical, the larger sweep of history is beyond their abilities to alter in most cases. You know, although, again, you kind of pointed out this really interesting story of the, you know, the, which I had forgotten, of the liberation of Paris, you know, the all the stuff that went into that, which was including that the there was tension between de Gaulle, who was the, you know, essentially the leader of the Free French Army, wanting to liberate Paris immediately as quickly as possible after D-Day, and the Allies overall saying
had no interest in the immediate. They wanted to kill Germans. They didn't want to liberate capitals. That was what George Patton told a member of the resistance who had snuck through the lines. And it was incredibly frustrating to them. But finally, de Gaulle, basically, there is a French... Churchill, being the great, great genius of World War II, had realized maybe a year earlier, I think in 1943, that it was going to be very important that French troops participate in the liberation of Paris. And he asks Eisenhower to bring French troops over from England, which Eisenhower eventually does, though not until... July of 44, so not until like a month after the Normandy invasion. So at this point in August, there is a division of French troops who presumably are more loyal to de Gaulle than they are to the Allied command. And de Gaulle makes kind of, at the very end, he makes sort of a veiled threat to Eisenhower saying, you know, if you don't go in, I'm just going to tell them to go in. And that's about a day or two before Eisenhower finally. And the thing that really brings Eisenhower around is that he feels tremendous gratitude to the French resistance for the 1,000 acts of sabotage that they carry out in the days immediately after the Normandy invasion. And there's no question that what they did was crucial to preventing the Germans from reinforcing their positions in the immediate aftermath of the invasion, and therefore they were crucial to its success. And de Gaulle is very explicit about all of that in his own... I mean, Eisenhower is very explicit about all of that in his memoirs.
But still, there was... I mean, what you also, I thought, did really well was capture the complexity of the relationships between... and motives, in fact, also for de Gaulle, and that, you know, it was just...
Well, nobody liked de Gaulle. Certainly Churchill didn't like de Gaulle, and Roosevelt hated de Gaulle, but Churchill at least always realized how important he was going to be to the success of their general effort. You know, Roosevelt really spends quite a long time flirting with the idea of being friendly with the Vichy government, which obviously enrages de Gaulle on the way to coming around to the right position.
So let me ask you, I mean, this is sort of a turn to another area that the book raised for me, and that is this whole notion of, you know, thinking about what it would be like when you individually are faced with making decisions about how you'll act, how you'll behave in these fraught moments. I've thought about this also, you know, I think I told you before we started recording, I read a book recently called Irina's Children, which is about a woman, actually a group of social workers, principally in Warsaw, who saved Jewish children. And they were most of the people that did this were not Jewish. They were Catholic, and they just, you know, repeatedly, risk their lives to do these heroic acts without ever thinking. I mean, they obviously did think about what the potential danger was, but they just acted. And yet many, many other people either did not act heroically or acted, in fact, in the other way anti-heroically, let's say. And I think in France, where you have a similar situation, you know, they were conquered by Germany, occupied by Germany, and a part of the French people actively collaborated with the Germans, a part actively opposed. And then the vast majority just survived, just tried to
get a vast majority spent most of their time trying to get enough to eat.
Right. And I guess,
which,
you know,
is not easy.
No. And, you know, it's easy to make judgments, especially 75 years later with the time having passed, and, you know, we're not in that kind of situation. So you kind of try to figure out how one would act in a similar circumstance.
And there is a terrible smugness in America, a terribly unjustified presumption that if we had been in the same situation, obviously we would have behaved very differently. Whereas the central fact of World War II is that in the United States, the civilian population suffered nothing at home to speak of, except for a little rationing and so on, but no occupation, no dislocation, no mass arrest, nothing like what every European country that was occupied Germany suffered through. And I actually think that that's one of the reasons why World War II did a better job on the whole of inoculating Western Europe against war than it did in the United States, because the experience was so disastrous for everybody, not just for the soldiers who died, but for the civilians as well. And I think that's why the European nations have succeeded at least this long in repeating this kind of catastrophe. Although the question that I end the new afterword to the book with is, really, is it possible to sustain the lessons of a catastrophe like World War II after the last person who was alive then has died?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that it is.
No, I think that is really a crucial question. And it kind of was where I was headed, was like, you know, when you think about how much time has passed, how many generations have passed, you know, as the last remaining war criminals die off, or the last remaining heroes pass away, and we don't have the direct experience of what that was like, what does that mean? You know, how I noted that André Bouloche, Christiane and Jacqueline's brother, who was really, you know, he was tremendously active after the war in politics and in sort of an active effort to overcome any sense of revenge that people might feel or hatred of the Germans. You know, he was really a kind of
That was pretty much the whole thrust of his public life. And as Mitterrand, the first socialist president of post-war France, he was the first to turn towards the Germans and say, "Our friends."
Yeah.
A remarkable thing to be able to do.
Incredible.
Someone who had survived three German concentration camps.
Yeah, I know. I was struck by that. And the question then is, does that act, or those set of actions, do they influence sufficiently the generations that follow? Or does it diminish? I mean, that's probably the question you're asking in your own writing is, you know, is it enough? Will that indirect experience be enough to?
I think it was enough for the children of the main actors here, all of whom are very political and very pro-democracy, and none of them, I quote one of them as saying, none of us could ever be an anti-Semite, and all of us have voted on the left basically since the end of World War II. But whether it's enough for the generation after them is an open question.
Yeah, it's sort of raised a little bit by current events here, where we are seeing a public language of anti-Semitism and, anti-otherness in the public discourse that really we have not seen so active in a long time. And I wonder if it, you know, thinking about it in terms of time.
I feel an intense echoes of the 1930s in the current era, especially in the willingness of the left to devour itself, possibly so much as to allow an extremist like Donald Trump to become president, which is why the people I know who are on the left and still unwilling to vote for Hillary Clinton drive me out of my mind.
That's a feeling you and I have shared.
Yeah.
It's and of course, you know, this interview may actually run
after the fateful moment.
That's correct. So we will not be able to know as we are speaking today what will be the outcome, but I'm actually more concerned than by that particularity of what might happen in the election. I think, you know, I am concerned about that, but I am perhaps more concerned by the nature of the public discourse, you know, the sort of Pandora's box being opened. And
oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you're absolutely right. It's been opened in a way that is unlike anything in yours and my lifetime. I mean, there was a gigantic effort, and a lot of it had to do with the tremendous reaction against anti-Semitism after World War II, combined with the tremendous effort of the civil rights movement to improve the African-American population. But none of this stuff happens by itself, and none of this stuff stays the same by itself. You know, all of it's necessary for evil to triumph is for the decent people to do nothing. And, you know, the energy, the political energy, most of the political energy in the United States since 1968 has been on the right, and, you know, and the Koch brothers and so on and so forth. So the gigantic investments have all been made by the right wing to change the way Americans think, and it has had a substantial and, I would argue, very negative effect on our body politic.
I agree completely. I think that there's, you know, we've seen an active, sustained, well-financed, and organized effort to oppose what was thought of as the counterculture ideas of the 60s. And it was, you know, there was political repression around that. As well as, I think the larger effort was really one of social control and social influence. And I agree with you. I think that we've seen 40 years of propaganda and its effects.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult for all of us. I mean, in a way, it takes us back to the question that I raised earlier, which is if, you know, how one would act in the face of fascism, let's say, or a threat to freedom, you know, in our own country. Well, gee, seems like
when I was 16, I was very sure of the answer to that question. As a very grown man, I have no firm conviction about what I would have done if I had been the age I am now in 1940 in France. But of course, that's part of the story of the book. Is it's the kids in this family who are the activists, and the parents and the oldest brother do not join the resistance actively. And I've always thought that a lot of this had to do with the impetuosity of youth, and also the fact that you just have a lot less to risk when you're 19 than you do
well, that's
when you're
right.
50 and the
right.
mother or father of four children and so forth.
Right. No, I think the two factors that go hand in hand are one, as we know, when we're younger, we think that we can't imagine a future, so we're able to live in the present in a different way. As you get older, you know what the risks and costs are far better, sometimes to the detriment of taking action.
Yeah, absolutely.
And but it is also true that, you know, that you need the vigor of youth to be able to do those things that, you know, the children did. And of course, you know, again, without giving away too much of the book story, what you just mentioned is, of course, one of the ironies of the book.
The crucial irony of the book.
Yeah. And, yeah. You know, it's one. And I thought that was really both tragic and painful, you know, for all. I mean, it was at the core of everyone's, of all of the people who lived through it. You know, it affected, it must have been one of the most powerful and difficult things for them, that those, you know, around them did not survive.
Well, of course, it was the most powerful experience of their lives, sure.
Yeah, well, I think you wrote this story really beautifully, and I'm pleased that I had a chance to read it. I thought it was, you know, it's an uplifting story, and it's also one that I think was thoughtful. You know, it caused one to reflect, and I think that's important.
Thank you. I had only one strategy, really, because of the extraordinary nature of the events. I wanted to write it as simply as I possibly could. I thought any attempt to be elaborate in my language would do nothing except detract from the power of the events. So there are a lot of very, very simple, but I hope sometimes elegant, declarative sentences in this book.
Well, I think that's actually a strength. You know, there are arguments about, you know, it's sort of like I when I learned book design many years ago, the principle that I kind of absorbed was that if a book is really well designed, you don't even notice that it was designed.
Right,
and
right.
I think that's true of writing. If writing is really good, it doesn't get in the way. You know, it allows the story to be told. It allows the reader to engage without thinking about extraneous matters. That's an elegance there.
That's my strategy always.
Well, your writing background is as a journalist. You know, you wrote.
And my hero is George Orwell, and who has five rules for writing, and the most important one is, well, there's two of them really. Never use a fancy word when you can use a simple word, and the other one is, if you can cut a word out, always cut it out.
Right. Right. Well, that's the poetry, you know, poetry at work, which is,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
the dictum of Ezra Pound was, you know, it was Latin, and I can't remember it exactly, but it was about condensing, you know, this
economy.
Right. Relentlessly taking out, which is great because many of us are overly loquacious when we write. And I think that, you know, I think you notice that there is perhaps less editorial rigor at work these days. So
my father was very editorially rigorous, and I was the third of three sons, and the main competition at dinner was to tell the best story. And if you told the story in the wrong order, my father would bellow at you from the other end of the table, "Great reporter, you buried the lead of the story." Well, after a while, you didn't do that anymore.
So was your father, I know he was a foreign diplomat.
He was a diplomat. He was not a journalist, but he was the greatest media freak I've ever known. He knew Ed Murrow. He was actually interviewed by Ed Murrow in London for a job in 1936, but I don't think he was offered a job. And then he came back to America. But he knew all the great journalists of his generation. And he read everything, and he was the best media critic I've ever known, really.
So, but he was lifetime foreign service?
He was more or less lifetime foreign. He was an unusual character because he was a career ambassador who only worked for Democratic presidents. So he worked for Truman and Kennedy and Johnson and Jimmy Carter. And when a Republican came to office, he had to figure out something else to do. So there were certain interregnums.
So what did he do during those interregna?
The first time when Eisenhower became president, we moved to Albany so he could work for Averell Harriman when Harriman was governor of New York. And then when Harriman was beaten by Nelson Rockefeller, we moved back to Washington and he became briefly a professor of international relations at American University. And then when he was in London, when Hubert Humphrey was beaten by Richard Nixon, Bill Benton, the old senator from Connecticut who owned the Encyclopedia Britannica, made him the head of the Encyclopedia Britannica in the UK so that he got to stay in England for another 8 years after he'd been in the embassy there.
Well, it sounds like he had you could call that a checkered career. Interesting.
It was a pretty great career, actually. He had a wonderful fun.
So,
for a nice Jewish boy from Brooklyn, he did quite well.
So now you obviously are writing books. What is the next? Do you have a next book in the works, and can you talk about it?
I have a next book in the works that I've been struggling with for about a year, and I have a new agent who has a good idea of how to frame it, and it's something about the last 40 years of New York City, but that's all I'm going to say. I have decided after the last one that there are two things that one can do. You can discuss your new book, or you can write your new book, and you rarely do both. So I'm going to try to write the next one and talk about it as little as possible.
That's probably accurate. I think that's a good idea. You know, unless until you've written it, enough of it. At a certain point, you can say, well, I've written enough of it. I actually got it done, so I can talk about it. But I can see how the talking might interfere with the writing.
Yeah, it does. It definitely does. It's because it's helpful to bottle up the story in you so that you have a compunction to get it out onto the page. Whereas if you're letting it out of you all the time, then there is no internal pressure to get it down.
Oh, right. No, I think that's right. I think for many of us who are not capable of writing a book, I've felt this way, that I'm better at talking about it than I am at actually doing it. So the corollary is, if you keep talking about it, you'll never do it.
Right.
So right. I think you're on the right track. And anyway, I think that I will look forward to your take on New York, which is a pretty rich.
I've been here since, I came here to be a freshman at Columbia in 1968, and I've been in the same 10-block area continuously, except for the 2.5 years I went to France to research The Cost of Courage. So I have had a very continuous New York experience. I also came out as a gay man the year after the Stonewall riots, so my gay life and the gay liberation movement are, they cover exactly the same period.
Yeah, which means that you are a good storyteller of that story as well. But that's that's another book. Well, thanks so much for talking to me about The Cost of Courage. I really
thank you very much.
Love the book. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Charles Kaiser about The Cost of Courage. Thanks.